Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Michelle Hussein. After a year of turmoil in the Middle East, we are discussing what is the path to peace. This may seem an odd way to begin this debate, but bear with me. Peace is such an immense, faraway word in the current context of the Middle East that it feels almost impossible to imagine, to even speak in those terms. At the same time, millions of people, Palestinians, Israelis, those living elsewhere in the region, those watching the raging conflict and the ongoing hostage crisis from elsewhere in the world, often say they long for hope, something to hold on to, something to aim for, some kind of resolution to an already decades-long dispute. For that reason, a path to peace for the purposes of this debate is not a perfect world or a perfect peace, but the space that lies beyond a ceasefire. That's what we'll be exploring in the next 40 minutes. How do Israelis and Palestinians get not just a lull or a quiet period, but to a point of faith that there can be a framework that offers justice and security? Now, normally a Today debate happens before a live audience, but this time, given that our panel is on three different continents, we are in a studio in BBC Broadcasting House in London. And joining us from Tel Aviv is Ehud Olmert, Israel's Prime Minister from 2006 to 2009. While in office, he offered a peace deal to the Palestinians, parts of it highly contentious to Israelis who didn't believe in a two-state solution. It was not accepted by the Palestinians, and after he resigned, Benjamin Netanyahu became prime minister. David Satterfield is with us from Houston, Texas, a former US ambassador to Turkey and Lebanon, and someone who was, until recently, President Biden's special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues. Afif Safir was born in Jerusalem in 1950 and in the late 1980s was involved in the talks that led to the first official US-Palestinian dialogue. He later became head of the Palestinian mission in London, Washington and Moscow and wrote a book called The Peace Process, From Breakthrough to Breakdown. Peter Ricketts was a British diplomat for many years, including on the Middle East desk during Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. He has also been UK National Security Advisor and head of the diplomatic service. Dr. Sanam Vakil is director of the Middle East and North Africa programme at the think tank Chatham House, and her work includes regional security, Gulf geopolitics and Iran's domestic and foreign policy. And also with us is our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who is in Jerusalem at the moment. Welcome to you all. You all represent different perspectives on this extremely important and emotive topic. And I'm going to start, Ehud Olmert, if I may, with you, a former Israeli prime minister. And in this quest of looking beyond a ceasefire, you recently put forward a plan that you worked on with a former Palestinian foreign minister. And it involves a big vision, creating a Palestinian state, including withdrawing from all but 4.4% of the West Bank. I wonder first, after the Hamas attacks and in the midst of this war, how you think you could persuade Israelis of that vision?
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm delighted to be part of this discussion. Obviously, as you say, when there is war, the word peace seems to be so remote and almost unachievable. And indeed, the mood in the country today is so far removed from the idea of two states, I guess, equally with many of the Palestinians. But I believe, and I found a partner who shares this belief with me, Dr. Nasser Kidwa, that this is precisely the time where we have to raise to the awareness of the international community everywhere we can, that there is a peace, a path for peace. There is. There is only path for peace. There is no other. If one day we will sign the peace between us and the Palestinians, it will be more or less almost identical to the plan that I presented with Dr. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, in 2008, and what, in principle, Dr. El-Kidwa and myself are now raising again. I know that it's difficult, but I always remind myself, and I venture to mention it now, that when Menachem Begin was elected Prime Minister of Israel in 1977, no one would have believed that a year after, he will agree to pull out completely from all of Sinai, which seemed like a miracle. And in 2004, no one would have believed that in 2005, General Ariel Sharon would agree to dismantle all of the Israeli settlements in Gaza that he himself built throughout his political career. So things can change. And what we try to do is we try to bring back into the awareness of the international community precisely now that people will know that at the end of this terrible experience that we have been through now, all of us, and I'm not going now to start and spread accusations. Everyone knows what happened, how it is went through, and what were the mistakes that were committed. What I felt, and I'm very happy that Dr. El-Kidwa felt with me, is that it's time now to present the perspective that can be the glimpse of hope that may change the attitude of all the possible players in this very difficult and very demanding and very painful process that we have been through. That's what we have proposed. You have outlined the principles, yes. So I don't have to repeat it.
Afif Safia, what do you think of what you heard? And perhaps I can ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Olmert, that I asked him how he'd persuade Israelis. How would you persuade Palestinians, including those who have turned to violence to achieve their means?
Well, I first of all would like to tell you that we, the Palestinians, we have been unreasonably reasonable. And in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, the victim moved beyond double negation towards mutual recognition much faster than the Israeli side. Number two, I personally believe that peace is doable on condition that there is an assertive role of the international community. What is acceptable democratically by the Israelis is not acceptable by the Palestinians, and vice versa. So I personally have been adopting the idea since decades that what we need is a sort of elegantly imposed solution by the international community, which is mutually unacceptable. Since both societies believe that the entire country is theirs, the two-state solution is this mutually unacceptable solution. And I personally believe the concept of mutual unacceptability has more potential than acceptability.
You're going to have to explain what you mean.
Let me tell you. The flow of the previous peace process, on which I wrote the book From Breakthrough to Breakdown, was that too much was left to the local belligerent parties to sort it out. And there is such an asymmetry that the Israelis were constantly tempted to dictate conditions. And the Israeli society, public opinion, started to believe if I vote Labour, I give back 85% of the occupied territories. If I vote Likud, I might give them back 40%. Peace is too important to be left to the Israelis to decide upon. And I personally believe that the ruling of the International Court of Justice some 2 months ago is fantastic because it is the summary of what we call international law. And what has happened in the last 5 decades was the following. It's not the world that aligned itself on our preference. It's we, because we are unreasonably reasonable, who adopted the international consensus of two states. Unfortunately, the cause of the deteriorating situation in the Middle East is the fact that we have witnessed the self-inflicted impotence of the international community. Self-inflicted. For example, the quartet was mainly a one-tet operation. The Americans did not allow other players to play a dynamic, important role. The Europeans were relegated to the position of being payers and not players, etc.
Okay, well, since you've mentioned the international community and the Americans, I'm going to bring in Ambassador David Satterfield, who, you worked until very recently for the Biden administration, and you've seen exactly how they've operated, Ambassador, in this phase. assertive diplomacy a role from the outside? Mr. Safi is essentially suggesting that Israelis and Palestinians are going to have to be led, if not forced, towards peace. Can you see an American administration being willing to play that sort of role again?
Well, I disagree fundamentally, based on history, with the idea that an external hand, the international community, is the key actor here. And it is why what Ehud and Nasser al-Kitwa are doing is so very important. It is the parties themselves that are going to have to evolve what arrangements they believe can work. This is highly complex. It's difficult. Israel is traumatized. Palestinians are traumatized right now. We understand that. But it is at exactly this moment when the concept of a negotiated, agreed two-state resolution needs to be underscored more firmly, more vocally than not. It's why the U.S. administration, quite correctly in my view, has continued to say in the face of very, very considerable, overwhelming, now is not the time to talk about this rhetoric. It's why you have to talk about it. You cannot have a day after in Gaza or in the West Bank unless that day after is based upon a pathway to a political horizon, which we believe strongly, the international community believes strongly, must be a two-state resolution. And you can like that outcome or you can be opposed to that outcome. But there is no credible argument that any other resolution will avoid what no one wishes, which is a restoration of full Israeli occupation, de facto or de jure, of Gaza, and a situation in the West Bank which deteriorates to the point of being its own generator of violence projecting beyond its borders. So one way or the other, that horizon of two states is the only resolution out here, and it needs to be reinforced, but it is something the parties themselves, with support, with encouragement, with help from the international community, yes, indeed, but not as a result of an ICJ mandate or court finding or an external intervention. That hasn't worked in the past. It won't work in the future.
But what do you do when the parties do not have equal power, when one is a state and one isn't?
Asymmetrical negotiations, which is what this is, occur around the world. And they are not bars to peacemaking when the will exists by the leaders of the factions or the states or the entities, and when they are broadly supported by the international community. So I'm not taking responsibility away from the international community at all. It has to be there. But it's the parties themselves that have to deal with each other.
Okay. Jeremy Bowen in Jerusalem, can you just help us out with the lessons of previous ceasefires? Because we have been in these cycles of previous wars, of course, shorter than what has happened now. But why did previous ceasefires not lead to anything substantive?
Well, if you're talking about the various wars that be between Hamas and Israel, it didn't lead to anything substantive because essentially they almost became, I hate to say, use the word ritualistic in the way that they were fought, because there would be a buildup of tension, it would explode into a period of violence, an exchange of fire, many more Palestinians killed than Israelis. Then after a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks sometimes, there would be a diplomatic intervention. The Americans would be involved, the Egyptians would be involved, maybe some other parties as well. And then there would be a ceasefire. And essentially the reason why nothing changed was because the essential issue behind it, which was everything that was going on in Gaza and the way that Hamas was regarded and the way Hamas regarded Israel, none of that had changed. So if you don't deal with the fundamental problem, which is this great big unresolved conflict that has gone on now for possession of this land that they both call home, that has gone on for more than a century, then it's a guarantee of continued violence. Of course, there was a peace process back in the 1990s, which for a number of rather complicated reasons ended. Some people said that the structure was wrong. Some people said that you couldn't trust either side. There were powerful forces on either side who wanted to undo it. The Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, was assassinated for trying to make peace by a Jewish extremist. And I felt at the time, I reported it here, that it was probably the most, certainly in the years after it became clear, it was a very successful political assassination, because the assassin got what he wanted, which was ultimately the end of the peace process. The death of Rabin was a factor in that. So I think what we're talking about is a load of factors which could not be overcome, and yawning underneath all of it is this underlying chasm. And unless that chasm is addressed properly, nothing will work.
But then this last year has seen unprecedented suffering by both peoples. If that doesn't change the dynamics, then what could?
You know, when all this started, I thought, and quite a lot of people who follow the Middle East, I think, had thought that for some years that an explosion of some kind was coming. I didn't think it would come out of Gaza. I thought most likely in the West Bank, maybe out of Lebanon, I'm not sure. But I thought an explosion was coming, and actually I did think too that maybe the only thing that could bring people to their senses, where they would sit down on the table and try and discard a lot of baggage and deal with the fundamentals, maybe the awful shock of mass bloodshed would do it. It hasn't happened right now, because of course what we're seeing is a Middle East war spreading and potentially about to get a lot more serious.
Well, let me bring in our other two members of the panel, and also remind everyone, whether you're just joining us or have been listening from the beginning, that really our ultimate aim in this conversation is to talk about what happens after a ceasefire. We can perhaps assume and hope that that does come, and then the question is how it could potentially be built on. So, Sanam Vakil from Chatham House. Now, the fact that in recent years, we have had some Arab countries normalize relations with Israel. Shouldn't that supposedly create the sort of framework for, at least within the region, a greater framework for movement and diplomacy?
Well, I think that certainly has been a lot of the scaffolding that many in the international community have been using to think about what comes after a ceasefire. And in fact, prior to October 7th, certainly the Biden administration was engaging in a grand bargain with Saudi Arabia and Israel, trying to deliver normalization as part of the process. What the Abraham Accords, the normalization arrangements, didn't achieve, or perhaps was misunderstood or brushed to the side, is these were bilateral, transactional, national interest oriented arrangements. They were not a big panacea for regional security. They were also not an anti-Iran alliance, as is oftentimes represented by policymakers in Israel.
And they also didn't involve the Palestinians.
And yes, that is the key issue. It did not address the key challenge that Arab states have tried to lobby for since the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative. But of course, they too are complicit in stepping away from lobbying for Palestinian self-determination. So this model is, let's say, incomplete, and on its own cannot deliver security for Israel, certainly statehood for Palestinians, but it definitely cannot address regional security.
Are these Gulf states and other countries like Saudi Arabia, are they worried about the impact of this war on their populations, the resonance of this conflict?
Absolutely. I think this has been an extraordinarily challenging year for most countries in the Middle East, but for Gulf states in particular that have been trying to put their national interests and their economic diversification projects ahead of conflicts in the region, they have definitely been compromised. They also have, Saudi Arabia in particular, has a very young population that for the first time, I would say in a generation, has been politicized over this war. And there is pressure, even within an authoritarian system, to consider the issue of Palestine. And this has led to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince, the Saudi Foreign Minister, even a few days ago in the Financial Times, making it clear that normalization with Israel is now really predicated on addressing the issue of Palestinian self-determination. So in thinking about the future, thinking about the broader pathway to peace, certainly Arab states have a role to play. But I think there needs to be a constituency in Israel. There needs to be leadership in Israel and Palestine. But above all, and I think this is what's also missing, engagement with Israelis and Palestinians on the ground. Too oftentimes, peace is imposed from above and not engaged with from below.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service with me, Michelle Hussein, discussing 1 year on, what is the path to peace in the Middle East?
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Peter Ricketts, the resonance of this has been felt in right around the world in many ways, including in this country.
Yes, of course. I mean, any conflict in the Middle East will immediately have implications in the UK, on the communities here, of course. We've seen the demonstrations and the tensions here, but also for diplomatic interests of countries around the world as well. And we haven't yet much talked about the Iran dimension to this, but an escalating crisis between Israel and Iran could have very serious consequences, including economic consequences. So, yeah, this is a crisis that concerns everyone.
And you know how diplomacy works. Can you imagine the appetite for an international effort to really get involved, whether it's the Security Council? I know that's hard to imagine because of Russia and Ukraine, but is this conflict going to be solved in an international way, or is it going to be Israelis and Palestinians who do it?
I mean, this conflict will eventually end. All wars end finally. The issue, I think, is how it ends. Will it be in continued Israeli occupation, smashing the enemy to the point where they're surrendering? Is that a way of breaking the cycle of violence? No, I don't think it is. That's been tried before. Benjamin Netanyahu's security first policy has clearly not worked in terms of providing security for people in Israel. So the question then becomes, how do you turn the military successes that Israel is having into something which is a political outcome? Personally, I agree with David Satterfield that the initiative's got to come from within the region. It's got to come from within Israel and Palestine. We're probably talking about a new generation of leaders on both sides. The ideas are not lacking. The cupboards of foreign ministries are full of peace plans. It's the political will and the statesmanship to look beyond the quarrels of the last 80 years and see that there is a better way to do this. It's been the most frustrating thing about the last year in diplomacy terms. The Israelis have not set out any thinking, really, about how they plan to deliver a better, more secure future for Israeli people as a result of their military activities. And it's that jump to get beyond the security first policy into a willingness to look at a peace settlement with the Palestinians. The two-state solution, it's a truism now to say that it's dead, but it is the only way that people have thought of for two ancient peoples to live together in the same small strip of territory.
Ehud Olmert, are there any back channels? Is there anything going on that you detect behind the scenes? You know, I know it's obviously your conversation with Nasser Kudwa, but neither of you are in a position of power anymore. Do you think on the Israeli side, do you think there is a plan for what comes afterwards, or is there only a military plan?
I have to be very sincere and open with you. I don't think that there is any plan on the Israeli side which comes close to what I and Dr. Al-Kidwa have proposed. This plan is not new to the Israeli people. They are all aware of it. They were when I was prime minister in the year 2008, perhaps some did whatever they could to get rid of me precisely because of this. Some of those elements killed Rabin because they were afraid that he was going to make an agreement that was based on concessions that will almost inevitably involve the withdrawal for most of the territories. So, look, I don't want to argue with Mr. Sofia about, I think he's mistaken. I think that this is an attitude that relieves oneself of the responsibility for his own future, for his own lives. And this is something that I can't accept for myself and for my people, for my country. It's true, as you say, presently there is no Israeli government which thinks about not the day after, has no strategy about how to end the war, has no strategy about how to avoid now a comprehensive a confrontation with Lebanon and possibly also with Iran. So, you know, I could spend the whole time you can give me in order to repeat my complete disassociation with the Israeli government and the lack of policies and the lack of responsibility and the lack of strategic perception of what should be done. But we have to take it one step further. You know, since I'm not a prime minister and since Dr. Kidwa is not a foreign minister now, we are free to re-emphasize that which is the only possible way to one day come close to a resolution of one of the most troubling confrontations in the world today, which can generate something much more dangerous to the stability of not just of the region, but of the whole world, if it will continue in the direction that it takes now. Because my fear is that sooner than later, you know, we will obviously respond to the Iranian attack. The Iranians will then perhaps respond also. And at some point, perhaps America will get into this and it will become something entirely different. So while all this is in the making, there must be an alternative road which is presented, which has to come out from within. It has to come out from ourselves. And what I'm trying to do is, of course, I spell it out every opportunity I have, and I talk with people, and I try to move the as many Israelis of consequence that I can in order to convince them that this is the time. When someone says, because of the war, because of the pains, because of the aggravations that so many people feel about the Palestinians, it's the wrong time. I said, precisely because of this, this is the right time, because this is the only option that we can show to the people that there may be a different future. And I think the same has to come from within the Palestinians. I mean, on top of what Dr. Al-Kidwa is gallantly and courageously doing, I want to just conclude by saying one thing. There are many, many contacts, backdoor channels, you can say, between Israelis and Palestinians. We live together. We are neighbors. We cross the roads of each other.
Mr. Olmert, we are in a situation of unavoidable coexistence. The challenge is how to create a more civilized relationship, bilateral relationship.
Okay, but that's what we try, that, Mr. Sofia. That's what we need to do and to push for from our side. No one will make peace for us. No one will make it. Only us will make it. We are very close to it. We are very close to it. I don't want to go now into debates and accusations, all of this. Believe me, in September of 2008, it was on the table with a divided Jerusalem, with the holy city, the old city of Jerusalem, without any exclusive political sovereignty of anyone, with resolution of the conflict or of the issue of the refugees within the context of the Arab League Peace Initiative, with a Palestinian state on the borders of more or less of 67, equal size, with annexation of 4% and swaps of the same equal size territory, with a connection between Gaza and Gaza and the West Bank. Everything was on the table. It didn't work. I don't want to accuse anyone. We have to bring it back. Okay. Bring it back and fight for it. Rather than argue amongst ourselves, fight together in order to have people like Rob Ricketts and David Satterfield from Houston and the James Baker Institute, which he runs there, and move everywhere in the globe in order to present this as an alternative that will be supported, but it has to come from within.
We got your point, Mr. Olmert. Mr. Olmert, for me, you are a very interesting Israeli politician because in 2008, you wanted to make peace with the Palestinian side because you thought that it might also prolong your political career. Contrary to you, today, Netanyahu believes that he has to perpetuate war in order to prolong his political career. This is why I have respect for you and not respect for Mr. Netanyahu.
Do you think it was a Palestinian mistake not to accept?
Mr. Olmert,
don't monopolize, please, the session.
I believe that
the Palestinian side hesitated because then the popularity ratings of Mr. Olmert were relatively low. His coalition was fragmenting and it was at the end of his term of duty, unfortunately, because I believe he was an interesting interlocutor. Now, I hope that he will have many disciples now in Israeli society, because in my scenario, when we reach moment M, meaning an international consensus for a decisive role, I hope that there is as substantial an Israeli minority as possible there to carry the idea forward. I am in favor of the two-state solution, and I personally believe the battle, our battle for peace in the Middle East, is won or lost in Washington. Up to now, unfortunately, we are losing it. I'm going to borrow two words from Mr. Netanyahu. Unfortunately, during his speech in Congress some 2 months ago, the useful idiots on Capitol Hill emboldened him to come back and escalate the wars in the Middle East. Why? Because of the repeated standing ovations after each of his utterances of monumental belligerent platitudes. Now, I personally believe that there should be a decisive role. I'm nostalgic, Lord Rickett, of President de Gaulle. De Gaulle, Michel, after the War of 67, floated an idea of his own, which was la concertation à quatre, the coordination of the major four powers. China was not yet in the Security Council. And this idea that those four major powers would agree on what is desirable, doable, possible, acceptable, and signal to the local belligerent parties what the world expects from them. Today, my dear, we all have to recognize that because of the belligerency and the war undertaken in Palestine and in Lebanon, the popularity ratings of Mr. Netanyahu are improving, and they will continue improving. And let me tell you why, where he draws his inspiration. Ben-Gurion, if you read the diaries of Moshe Sharet, the first Israeli foreign minister, Sharet tells us that those who came to Ben-Gurion in 47 to criticize his acceptance of the partition plan, Ben-Gurion told them, "My friends, we need to learn how to provoke the Arabs into provoking us so that we can expand beyond the narrow boundaries we have had
but
to
I
accept."
But I don't think you've acknowledged something that Mr. Olmert said earlier on, which is, where is your inward conversation? Where is your conversation about we Palestinians also have to look deep and do hard things?
Let me tell you. The mainstream Palestinian politicians and politics and public opinion are in favor of the two-state solution. And how many times have Hamas signaled that they are ready to accept it? Unfortunately, the world did not believe them, the world did not test them, the world did not try them. But I also believe that Hamas, if ever offered a two-state solution, a Palestinian independent state, will also acquiesce. And I personally believe that, unfortunately, the world is unaware that the Middle East is made not of a monolithic group. For example, Iran. Netanyahu is itching for a war with Iran and wants to drag the Americans into that. Nobody is giving a chance to the new president of Iran, who's supposed to be an accommodationist, who wants to open up and organize an ouverture towards the world. And nobody
is... And in between... shooting 200 ballistic missiles into Israel. What exactly?
But making sure that they don't do too much damage. But making sure that they don't do too much damage.
Okay.
Well, come on.
I'm going to turn back to Ambassador David Satterfield. What would incentivize a U.S. president to be properly engaged?
I'm happy to answer that, but I have to have a bit of response to what was just said. Look, the Arab states recognize, perhaps belatedly, that a resolution or a process that can credibly said to be working towards a resolution of the Israel-Palestinian conflict is important for their own security. There's no question of that today. However reluctantly, they have been drawn back into this issue, and in the case of many of the Gulf states, it's quite reluctantly, they acknowledge it. You hear a uniform declaration from all of the Gulf states, from Qatar, from the Emirates, from Saudi Arabia, of the need for a credible pathway, or words to that effect, towards a negotiated two-state resolution. There's not going to be a Saudi deal with the United States and Israel, minus such a pathway, such a political horizon. You're not going to see the engagement of Arab states in Gaza, either on stabilization efforts, should there be a day after, or on reconstruction, minus that political horizon. And that political horizon, very much in the case of Gaza, encompasses a concept of Gaza unified politically with the West Bank, as well as Palestinian Authority participation in the gradual progressive restoration of administration in Gaza. Now, having said that, which Palestinian Authority? There is similarly a near universal view that major dramatic reforms in the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah will be required. The UAE is on one end of the spectrum, calling literally for a completely new PA. The Saudis have a more nuanced position. But we cannot have this discussion without acknowledging the stature of the Palestinian Authority itself and its present leadership is in low repute.
What would you do about this?
It is not solely a product of Israeli actions, harmful as they have been. It is corruption. It is decrepitude. It is the suppression of new generations of leaders coming, a process perfected by Yasser Arafat in his later years and sadly continued after his passing. Changes have to come on that side as well. So what's needed here, whether it's in Washington or other capitals, it is two things. It is Israeli support for the concept of that two-state resolution that we all continue to hold out. It is a Palestinian Authority viewed as genuinely competent and capable of leading, and which has the support of critical partners in the region and critical support outside. That's a hard list of things to be done, but they're all going to be necessary. And minus them, you are not going to have a meaningful day after. And 6 months from now, we are going to be discussing not the same situation, but a much deteriorated situation in Gaza, in the West Bank. I have greater optimism or less pessimism for Lebanon and Iran, perhaps. But with respect to Gaza, you're not going to get to the day after. You're not going to get to the day before, minus this kind of political vision.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. I'm going to come to Jeremy and then Sanam Vakil and Peter Ricketts. Jeremy, the sequence of what could be a credible pathway. Sequencing is really important, wasn't it? In the Oslo Accords, there were different stages, and then they were never completed, essentially.
Yeah, I spoke recently to Yossi Beilin, who was one of the leading Israelis in the Oslo years, pushing the peace process. And he said one of his biggest regrets was the fact there was a prolonged interim period where essentially they didn't get on with dealing with the big issues like the future of Jerusalem, of Palestinian refugees, where the borders would be, etc. So he said if they did it again, they'd have to get on with it, go straight. As Peter Ricketts said, foreign ministries are full of plans about how they could do this. So let's not talk, he said. Just get on with it if you're going to do it next time. Let me add one thing about the two-state solution and trying to make it happen. I think for quite a few years now, Western countries have all said, yes, of course we're behind the two-state solution. And they said it so often it became an empty slogan. Why was it empty? It's because they were, a lot of the time, enabling measures that Israel was taking, particularly the massive expansion of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories and places Palestinians want for a state, which meant that while on one side they were saying, yes, they wanted it to happen, they weren't actually saying anything when they saw Israel doing many, many things that was that were actually designed to stop it happening.
Peter Ricketts.
One of the most striking things of the last year has been how powerless the Americans have been actually to affect Israeli actions. There's been a lot of American pressure for ceasefires, excuse me, but in the end, arms supplies have continued and Netanyahu has brushed them aside. And we are in a phase now where Netanyahu will go to the end of his security policy in the hope that he can reach some sort of settlement. What Western countries need to be doing practically, I think, is to be dusting down the plans, to be working with the moderate Arab countries, to be ready when there is a leadership in Israel and Palestine who are prepared to make the leap towards peace, that the plans are all there, and also the broader perspective, so that there is a deal with Saudi Arabia available to Israel to bed it into one of the most dynamic regions in the world, provided that they can provide that perspective towards a Palestinian state.
Do you think Iran wants a two-state solution? Salam Vakil?
Certainly it has been working to obstruct a two-state solution for many decades now. But I do think that without Iranian buy-in, any such plan will have holes poked in by Iran or by other groups in the region. So I think it is incumbent upon the international community and regional states to bring Iran in. Iranian leaders in the past have said that they support Palestinian self-determination. So give Palestinians the right to determine their future and allow Iran to make good on that claim.
So a seat at the table if there was a grand conference, Iran should be there.
Well, certainly if we go back to Madrid in 1991, after the Gulf War, Iran wasn't at the table. And certainly there is analysis that has been conducted by think tanks, including by mine, that suggests that bringing Iran in, making it a party to international negotiations, will force accountability on Iran and perhaps over time restraint and a change of its behavior. But that also is a separate process that has to come in tandem with a peace process, a political horizon for Israel and Palestine.
Thank you all so much. This is a really big topic. I've asked you all to cast your minds into the future in the hope that together we would be able to point towards what I called right at the beginning of this program, the space that lies beyond a ceasefire, and how Israelis and Palestinians get not just a lull or a period of quiet, but to a framework for the future. Thank you all for being part of this today debate. Thank you, David Satterfield, Afif Safir, Ehud Olmert, Sanam Vakil, Peter Ricketts, and also from Jerusalem, Jeremy Bowen. The Today Debate was produced by Sinead Heakin and Louisa Lewis. Our editor is Owena Griffiths, and the studio director was Ben Andrews. Thank you for listening.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.